Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
With the nation gripped by impeachment hearings, anger and tribalism appear to be at an all-time high, creating political and societal rifts that seem unbridgeable. Last fall, I spoke with Liliana Mason, a political psychologist at the University of Maryland, about the reasons behind the party tribalism and enmity that characterize our politics. She told me that only 70 years ago, the country was deemed by political scientists to be not polarized enough, leading to confusion and disengagement on the part of the electorate.
Yes. So in the best possible way, parties are what we call heuristics. So they're cognitive shortcuts that we use to make political decisions, because we can't ask our citizens to read every page of every bill that comes before Congress. And so parties have been a useful way for people to make pretty easy and quick political choices. In 1950, the American Political Science Association put out a report recommending that our parties were not distinct enough from each other, and that they therefore did not provide a clear enough choice for voters, and that it was making people's political decision-making too difficult.
So if the Republicans weren't the conservative party 70 years ago, what were they?
In the 1950s, this is pre-Civil Rights Act, the two parties were effectively a mixture of liberals and conservatives. The Republican Party, up until that point, really had been the party of the North. The Republicans had been the party of Abraham Lincoln and the Union, while the South was the Confederacy. The Democratic Party represented a collection of conservative Southerners, as well as some more economically liberal Northerners, whereas the Republican Party was a Northern economically conservative party, but still had plenty of relatively liberal people in it.
So what caused the change? Was it Nixon's Southern strategy to coalesce a base based largely on racial fear? Was it the long list of culture wars battles that had already begun, from the Civil Rights Act to Miranda to school prayer to abortion? What was at the heart of this reconstitution of the party?
It really started after the Civil Rights Act of 1964, when Southern Democrats started moving away from the Democratic Party over the period of decades. And it took quite a long time for racially conservative Southerners to feel comfortable calling themselves Republicans. So part of the process was really just decades of gradual movement away from the Democratic Party for these racially conservative Southerners. As they became more comfortable being in the Republican Party, then their interests had to be represented by the party. So racially conservative interests began to be represented by Republicans more than Democrats. And also, we had these culture war issues happening. And some of this was religion. And so really during the 1980s and early 1990s, the religious right became politically active, and they felt that the party that best represented their interests would be the Republican Party. Most of the requests of the religious right organizations had been completely installed into the Republican Party platform by the year 2000. So there was really a combination of a racial attitude realignment and a realignment of which religious groups felt comfortable in which parties.
Now, what you've described is really the wholesale resorting of the electorate into more easily defined worldviews, right? Leaving us not just to parties, but to tribes. What is the psychology of that tribalism? And maybe we can begin with the Robbers Cave experiment that you've written about.
So in 1954, some psychologists collected a bunch of fifth grade boys from the Oklahoma City area and really tried very hard to make sure that all the boys were very, very similar to each other, psychologically, socially, in terms of their academic abilities, sort of in every possible way they were similar to each other. They were all white and Protestant boys. And they divided them into two camps. And they kept the boys completely separate for the first week of camp. And the boys came up with their own names for what their camps were called. One was the Rattlers and one was the Eagles. And in the second week, they let them know that there was another camp down the road. And immediately, the boys wanted to have a competition. And the experimenters encouraged this. And the more the boys competed, the more they began to hate each other. They called each other nasty names. And then things began to fall apart. They began throwing rocks at one another. And at one point, it got so violent that the experimenters had to separate them because they were so worried about the boys' safety. So really, all that it took was separating them into two different groups, allowing them to form an identity, and then letting them sort of have at each other. And, you know, we all like to think that we're more mature than fifth grade boys, and hopefully we are. But in general, that motive is a very deep-seated psychological motive. Once we are in a group, we think our group is the best, and we think that the other groups are less good. And if we're in competition with those groups, we begin to hate them.
What's interesting to me is that these groups that were placed in opposition to one another, in the circumstances, it was strictly arbitrary. It was random. When we're speaking of tribalism, what is the role of deliberation and judgment and agency? How much of this is free will and how much of it is just who we happen to be born as?
That's a very deep question. Part of it comes with, you know, the way that we were raised. And even partisanship is something that some of the earlier scholars of political behavior said, you know, that partisanship is something that's learned at your mother's knee. If you live in a political household, you grow up learning that you're a partisan. In a similar way that you grow up learning that you are, you know, a Christian if you go to church. And some identities are unavoidable, like race. Some identities are things that we choose. But the most important thing to know about identity is that whether it's something that is given to you or you choose, the most powerful identities are the ones whose status is being threatened. And it's important that it's the threat to the status, not just whether the status is high or low. Because if you are in a traditionally high status group, or you think of your group as being sort of the best or the most powerful, and either you think that the group is becoming less powerful or you think that weaker groups are becoming more powerful in relation to you, that makes people pay a lot of attention to their groups and to their identities. And it's very easy to make people think about one identity or another simply by telling them that someone has insulted their group or that their group is about to lose in some type of competition. When we see politicians talking about identities or groups, one thing that they have a lot of power in is helping us think about which groups are most important to us by telling us which groups are the most threatened.
All right, I understand this notion of winning and losing and feeling that your side is under threat. But back in the supposedly hypo-partisan 50s, many voters actually toggled between parties based on the economy or wars or other transitory circumstances. What do voting records show about today? Is it about issues or is it just threats to the tribe, to the Rattlers or the Eagles?
Yeah, that's one of sort of the most concerning things that's been happening in recent decades. In fact, many people make their political decisions largely just on partisanship. What that means is that, you know, we can actually see people's issue positions change depending on the position that their party takes. And a party can almost completely reverse positions on something, like, you know, a good recent example of this is trade. And many partisans will simply follow along. The fact that a party could switch positions and maintain its voting base almost completely, that's actually a very concerning development because it removes accountability. And like you said, in the 1950s, when people would switch between parties if the party did something that upset them, that was a mechanism by which voters held elected officials accountable. And without that ability, it's a lot harder for voters to hold not only elected officials accountable, but also to even pay attention to what their elected officials are doing, because the most important thing in their mind is whether or not the party is winning.
All right. So in effect, we're talking here about a sort of institutionalized hypocrisy where we're willing to support a policy that we always thought we were against for the sake of having our team win.
There was a Pew study. People were asked whether they approved background checks for gun purchases at a federal level. 86% of Republicans agreed that this would be a good policy to have in place. And then they were asked whether they believed that the government should pass a bill enacting background checks at a federal level. And once it was phrased that way, only 50-something percent of Republicans agreed that a bill should be passed. This is largely because we've started to think about legislation as winning and losing for one party or the other. And so these people who believed that the legislation would be good for the country as a whole also believed that it would be bad for their party to enact this legislation. And so there's sort of a disconnect between what's good for the country and what's good for the party. And in those scenarios, there are a substantial number of people who will choose the party's victory over what they think is best for the nation as a whole.
You know, it's one thing to be upset when you're losing. It's another thing altogether to be upset when you're winning. I want to go back to the 90s for a minute. While the GOP, as we've discussed, was becoming the party of conservatism, and now I would say arch-conservatism and white identity, the Democratic Party became the party, by default, I guess, of minorities, the party, as it was characterized, of big government, the party of organized labor. And its political response, especially after being crushed in the midterms, was a Clinton administration that governed increasingly toward the right.
For so long, government has failed us, and one of its worst failures has been welfare. I have a plan to end welfare as we know it.
You could argue that Bill Clinton was carrying water for the GOP and accomplished policy goals that George H.W. Bush, his Republican predecessor, couldn't get through Congress. And yet, he was demonized by the right. Why?
That's a very good question. I think one of the things that Clinton was doing was trying to push back against the realignment that was very clearly happening, trying to say, we're still a diverse party with many different viewpoints. The Democratic Party can still be thought of as a big tent full of lots of different types of people. But at the same time, the Republican Party was really doubling down, saying, we're going to take this realignment and run with it. So we're going to be the party for white people. We're going to be the party for Christians, particularly for evangelical and fundamentalist Christians. The Republican Party was really choosing to be a racially and religiously consistent party, while the Democratic Party was sort of pushing back against taking the other side of that. And really only recently, I think, has the Democratic Party really fully embrace the idea that, well, okay, if the Republican Party is going to be the party of white, Christian, largely male, rural people, then the Democratic Party has to be the party of everybody else.
We're speaking of identity here. Did the Democratic Party have agency in that choice, or was it just consigned to being the party of whatever the GOP wasn't?
Well, they had agency. I mean, to any extent that any party has agency, they certainly did. But one of the things that I think wasn't fully understood in the 90s was that demographically the country was changing. Now we know that by 2050, white Americans will make up a minority of the American population. In the 90s, that wasn't quite as well understood. And so the political strategy of the time was to try to get as many white voters as you could. You know, the Democratic Party was trying to compete against the Republican Party for white voters who were interested in liberal economic policy, for instance, or supportive of union organization. So really, both parties were going after white voters of different political inclinations. And I think it's been in recent years that the Democratic Party has realized, you know, that as the Republican Party tacks more to the right in terms of its racial positions, it makes sense for the Democratic Party to be the party of not just progressive white people, but also everyone else, and to think about it more as a strategic good for them to embrace those more diverse politics.
Well, this whole conversation is premised on the idea of opposing tribes. And, you know, it's clear that by every definition, the GOP has turned into a tribe, ethnic and otherwise. The Democrats, are they a tribe or are they sort of an ecumenical council?
When I think about partisanship as tribal, I think about it actually very much like a sports team fandom. You know, to the extent that we sit on election night and watch the election results come in and make our popcorn and drink our beer and at the end of the night either celebrate or feel very sad. Democrats are just as tribal as Republicans, right? Both parties want their party to win a lot. The difference is really that the Democrats are, like you said, sort of an ecumenical council of interests. And so when it comes to actually governing and choosing policies, there's a lot more debate within the Democratic Party about what policies should be followed or attempted. The way that we want our parties to win is similar, but the way that we think about our fellow partisans and what we demand in terms of partisan purity from our fellow partisans, that's different between the parties. One really interesting thing that I've been thinking about a lot recently is that it is still the case that on average, American policy preferences are generally liberal. There's a great book called Ideology in America that talks about how Americans are operationally liberal but symbolically conservative. And that means that the average American prefers generally liberal policies but identifies as conservative.
There's this weird ambivalence. And what explains that?
One possibility is that we just understand the word conservative differently than we understand our policy positions, right? It's possible to be religiously conservative and not necessarily economically conservative. People tend not to really understand what liberal and conservative means in practice, and that the term conservative is appealing to a lot of people. But when it comes down to it, would they like the government to be helping people? Yes, they would. But what that means practically in terms of our politics is that the Republican Party has a generally less popular set of policies than the Democratic Party does. When we think about the term identity politics, we tend to associate that with the Democratic Party. But ironically, when Democrats legislate, they tend to do things that are relatively popular. And Republicans' legislation tends not to be very popular. The tax cut bill that they passed, sort of the landmark accomplishment of the first 2 years of the Trump administration, is not very popular on average in the American electorate. This actually incentivizes the Republican Party to engage in this sort of identity-based rhetoric a lot more than the Democratic Party does, because they don't have a lot of policies to talk about. And so there is an imbalance. There's an asymmetry between the motives of the two parties. It is in the Democratic Party's best interest to talk about policy and to talk about what government can get done. It's not in the Republican Party's interest to talk about that kind of thing. And so it makes a lot more sense for them to talk about, you know, scary stories and threats and who's winning and who's losing.
We're talking about winning and losing. We're talking about this political moment where it is all important for the rattlers to defeat the eagles, even if they have to resort to violence. We live in a world where Giants fans murder Dodgers fans.
I think a couple of things are worrisome in that regard. One is the potential for the loss of the legitimacy of our electoral outcomes. If people don't trust the outcome of elections, then the basic machinery of democracy ceases to function. We don't have a mechanism in the Constitution for what happens if an election is fraudulent. And so these are kind of the weakest spots of our democracy, and they are being tested. We have seen violence and assassinations in American history. The 1960s were not a peaceful time. The difference is that today, those types of conflicts that we saw in the 1960s are mapped onto our partisanship. And so our elections determine how angry or happy we are with what's happening politically. And so elections can possibly become flashpoints for this type of violence.
Perhaps especially when the electorate has been groomed to believe that the system is rigged and that there is a deep state trying to delegitimize the elected administration and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And when one side is particularly encouraging of this, it ends up being an asymmetric effect where the vast majority of Americans don't believe that violence is acceptable at all, particularly in advancing political goals. But some partisans do. And there are enough partisans that accept political violence that it could become dangerous. Now, we can look to other countries. This is not my area of specialty, but there are other political scientists who study the emergence of civil war in other countries. And there's a political scientist named Joel Selway who does interesting work in this. And he says there are three major predictors of civil war. One is ethnic or religious fractionalization along political lines, which we have. Two is adverse regime change, which would be something like a contested election or an election outcome that many people feel is illegitimate.
Or an impeachment.
Right. But the third is economic catastrophe. That's the one thing that I think is really keeping Americans sort of settled down, is that the economy right now is, you know, relatively healthy, and comfortable people don't commit violence in general.
The history of political violence is a history of outgroups. Now, in this case, each party is literally the outgroup for the other. Does this bode well?
No, that's where this research started, trying to use theories that were developed to explain racial intolerance and apply them to the parties. The one thing that I will say is that the parties are distinct in the way that they're made up. If you pick one random Democrat and introduce them to another random Democrat, the chances that they share a race and a religion are going to be relatively small. What that means is that within the Democratic Party, under the party umbrella, there are a lot of different kinds of people. And one thing that we know from social psychology is that when your social world is relatively diverse, you tend to be more tolerant of outsiders. If you pick a random Republican and introduce that person to another random Republican, the chance that they're going to be the same race and religion is quite high. And so within the Republican Party, the sense of us versus them is going to be a little bit stronger, or maybe a lot stronger, because for Republicans, Democrats are not just a political outgroup, but they're also a racial and a religious outgroup. For Democrats, it doesn't work quite that way, because it's still 56% of the Democratic Party that's white. The Republicans are not a racial outgroup for 56% of Democrats. You can't say the same thing for Republicans. So the sense of us and them is different across the two parties. And to the extent that we could create more cross-cutting identities or a more diverse party itself, that really dampens this sense of who our outgroup is. And in fact, the Republican Party, just in 2012, after they lost the presidency, they had this autopsy report that said we need to try to reach out to Latino voters. If they had done that, they may have been a more racially diverse party, and there may be less animosity between the parties, because the sense of who is us and who is them would be slightly mixed up. They didn't go that way. It doesn't mean that they could never go that way, though. And so any increase in racial diversity within parties is something that could help reduce this sense of us and them.
Liliana, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Liliana Mason is a professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland and author of Uncivil Agreement: How Politics Became Our Identity. Thanks for listening to this week's Podcast Extra. This week on The Big Show, we have a deep, deep dive into a term you might have heard invoked on last week's show about Poland. The word is illiberal, and it deserves a second look. Tune in for that. And in the meantime, in case you haven't heard, there is now an OTM-inspired lipstick, and it's available to you for a pledge of support. We guarantee delivery before the holiday if you donate before December 6th. If you have no idea what the hell I'm talking about, sign up for the OTM newsletter at our website onthemedia.org, and all will be revealed. See you Friday. I'm Bob Garfield.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.